طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin this morning with news and analysis concerning the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that is increasingly becoming a major concern for Israel. While on the one hand, Israel takes the position that BDS is not really a threat to their economy, on the other hand, they are pouring millions of dollars into resisting the movement. Nora Barrows Friedman in the Electronic Intifada outlines how Israel is trying to use state legislative bodies to pass laws here in the United States to make illegal the use of BDS tactics. She writes, "A law being proposed in New York would create an official blacklist of supporters of the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Legal experts and activists say the measure is reminiscent of the McCarthy era and could have drastic consequences for individuals, organizations, or firms who engage with the campaign to pressure Israel to respect Palestinian rights. Two New York bills, one introduced in the state Senate and the other in the Assembly, would require the state government to develop, using credible information available to the public, a list of persons it determines boycotts Israel. Individual or entities included in the state's blacklist would be barred from partnering with state agencies unless they can demonstrate in a written statement that they are not engaged in boycotting Israel. State pension funds would also be prohibited from investing in institutions that have divested from Israel. Nearly two dozen North American-based activist organizations are opposing the legislation. The New York bills are the most egregious, most McCarthyite, most obvious violations of people's First Amendment rights," Josh Rubner, policy director for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, told the Electronic Intifada. "If passed into law, the measure could hit local organizations that provide essential community services. Church groups, for example, that may belong to denominations which have passed boycott or divestment resolutions, often receive state funds to provide social programs such as homeless shelters and soup kitchens. Does that mean that all these churches will become ineligible to feed the hungry? A resolution pending in the U.S. Congress, H.R. 567, would condemn the European Union's decision to accurately label goods produced in Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank and Golan Heights. Last year, Illinois adopted a first-in-the-nation, an anti-boycott law that established a screening mechanism to compel the state's pension board to exclude foreign corporations that have adopted BDS guidelines." Rubner said that the Illinois law is now a nationwide model for anti-BDS legislation. In California, financial planner turned ultra-conservative Republican legislator Travis Allen introduced legislation that seeks to punish businesses that engage with the boycott of Israel. One bill explicitly targets the BDS movement and would, in effect, oppose a state boycott of businesses or financial institutions in retaliation for any boycott of Israel. State pension funds would also be required to pull investments from companies that divest because of human rights concerns. The second bill does not mention Israel by name, but would prohibit any public entity from entering into a contract unless the contractor agrees not to boycott a member state of the World Trade Association. Allen's anti-BDS bill labels boycotts as discriminatory business practices, echoing claims used by the Israeli government that the BDS movement singles out Israel. In fact, boycott has been used as a tactic against many countries, as well as within the United States. The U.S. Supreme Court found in a landmark 1982 ruling on a case dating from the civil rights era that the right to use economic boycotts to pursue political ends is free speech protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. In a press release announcing the introduction of his bills, Allen praises the unique bond between the United States and Israel. He also notes that California is home to an estimated 2 million Jewish residents, in effect conflating Jews with Israel. In addition to Illinois, several states have passed anti-BDS laws or condemnatory resolutions in the last year, including South Carolina and Tennessee. As an anti-BDS resolution that was filed in Florida last month, which was backed by a major Christian Zionist organization, claims that the BDS movement is one of the main vehicles for spreading anti-Semitic perspectives and advocating the elimination of the Jewish state. A similar resolution in Indiana last year claimed that BDS promotes a climate of hatred, intimidation, intolerance, and violence against Jews. As of September 2015, more than two dozen anti-BDS bills and resolutions have been introduced at the local, state, and federal level, according to Palestine Legal. Israel has made it no secret that it views BDS as a major strategic threat, and the scale of the pushback by its allies in the U.S. is one indicator of panic about the growing momentum of this grassroots movement. But activists from California to New York are already organizing to oppose this kind of legislation. Essentially, these bills are more in a series of measures of all sorts by legislatures on campuses and elsewhere to try to undermine meaningful opposition to Israeli policies and U.S. support for them by stigmatizing and suppressing speech and nonviolent action in support of Palestinian rights. David Mandel, a member of the National Lawyers Guild and activist with Jewish Voice for Peace, told the Electronic Intifada. It's not saying that you can't speak freely or you can't boycott. It's saying that if you do, then you're going to be penalized by not getting the benefits of economic relationships with the state or its pension funds or other affiliated institutions, Mandel said. This legislation is an attempt to burden free speech, Mandel added, which is something that activists and constitutional rights attorneys will challenge. Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation sees the alarm shown by Israel's lobby groups and their legislative supporters as recognition of just how much of an impact this movement is having. I take it as a sign that the BDS movement is on the right track and is gaining traction and is being taken seriously by policy elites in this country, Rubner added. Clearly, the authors of these resolutions are fearful of the boycott movement because they understand the writings on the wall. That was excerpts from an article in the Electronic Intifada by Nora Barrows Friedman. Omar Barkhoudi also addresses the assault on BDS within Israel and the international community. Here he writes in Mondo Weiss, Despair is not always easy to detect, let alone smell. But recent Israeli efforts to fight BDS smell of deep despair, which is giving rise to hopeless aggression, even worse bullying, and patently irrational measures that can only help BDS to grow in the coming years. Particularly noteworthy are reports in the Knesset's anti-BDS caucus meeting, which convey the universal sense in Israel of failure to stem the BDS movement's growth and the admission that the impact of BDS may be growing beyond control. It is not every day that the unique colonial hubris and revolting arrogance of Israel's regime give way to an admission by the Minister of Strategic Affairs that the government of Israel cannot fight BDS alone. If, despite the massive U.S. and European Union support for Israel, providing its regime with billions of dollars in aid, a real iron dome of diplomatic and political protection against international sanctions, and deep levels of military, academic, cultural, and economic complicity, Israel has miserably failed in its fight against BDS. What else can we expect from it? Israel's options are limited and clearly fraught with serious risks. Israel's main strategy for fighting BDS since 2014 is its lawfare, legal warfare, crusade. It has been pulling all possible strings, mobilizing its entire lobby and the world Zionist networks to pass legislation against BDS in the U.S. states, to use its influence in France to depict BDS as illegal, and to recruit David Cameron's government to undermine BDS's support in British trade unions, city councils, universities, and civil entities. Lawfare, coupled with propaganda on steroids, has become Israel's final weapon against the BDS movement. The only problem for Israel in this approach is that in order for its attempt to legally delegitimize a nonviolent human rights movement like BDS to succeed, it and its Zionist lobby networks need to create a new McCarthyism that defies human rights, undermines civil rights, and tries to undo decades of mainstream liberal support for boycotts as protected speech, especially in the U.S., where it matters the most. As a result, Israel's lawfare has started to backfire, gradually eroding remaining pockets of non-Zionist liberal support and further amplifying the growing liberal disconnect with Israel's increasingly unveiled in-your-face repression, xenophobia, apartheid, fanatic Jewish fundamentalism, and ugly colonialism. Israel is becoming even more isolated at the grassroots level and even more dependent on extreme right forces in the West or elsewhere. If apartheid South Africa was arguably among Israel's closest friends for decades in the last century, today's Israel's best friends are the far right, openly racist, Islamophobic, anti-immigrant groups and governments, even those with fascistic tendencies that are in harmony with Israel's own. Just look at the Republican circus of presidential hopefuls for a hint. As the late Tony Jude wrote 13 years ago, quote, "In a world where nations and peoples increasingly intermingle and intermarry at will, where cultural and national impediments to communication have all but collapsed, where more and more of us have multiple elective identities and would feel falsely constrained if we had to answer to just one of them, in such a world, Israel is truly an anachronism. And not just an anachronism, but a dysfunctional one. In today's clash of cultures, between open, pluralistic democracies and belligerently intolerant, faith-driven ethnostates, Israel actually risks falling into the wrong camp." That was an article written by Omar Barghouti in MondoWise. Our feature presentation this week is a discussion between Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi and journalist Will Hillmans in the Journal of Palestine Studies TV. It has to do with an attack by the Zionist watchdog group CAMRA, Committee for Middle East Reporting in America, on Israeli author and Israeli historian Ilan Pape. CAMRA claims that Pape inaccurately accuses former Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion of ordering the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians during the 1948 military takeover of Palestine and establishment of the State of Israel. Historian Rashid Khalidi defends the Pape statement, which was made in an article published in the Journal for Palestinian Studies. What is so interesting about this attack by CAMRA is that they present themselves as a group dedicated to accurate reporting in the media, but really function as a zealous defender of Israel, including its penchant to promote a mythological Israeli narrative as factual reality. Here they accuse historian Pape of what they are so adept at doing, inaccurately citing history, but the facts support Pape. And once again, CAMRA is exposed for what it is, a tool of Israeli propaganda. Here are Professor Rashid Khalidi and Will Yeomans on the radio program broadcast of the Journal of Palestine Studies, which prides itself in an accurate scholarly examination of Palestinian history and therefore was compelled to defend the Pape article published in its pages.
Thank you for watching Palestine Studies TV. I'm your host, Will Yeomans. Last November, the pro-Israel watchdog group, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, or CAMRA, informed the Journal of Palestine Studies of an incorrect citation in a 2006 article by Israeli historian Ilan Pape. The incorrect citation referred to an inaccurate quotation by Israeli founding father David Ben-Gurion, which supported the expulsion or transfer of Arabs from Palestine. CAMRA asked JPS to, quote, issue a correction stating that the quote attributed to Ben-Gurion does not reflect in the references cited to prevent further erroneous uses of this quote. CAMRA's accusations that Pape invented or fabricated the quotation, to use their words, suggest that the Israeli leader never supported transfer. This led JPS to have the original source, Ben-Gurion's October 1937 letter to his son, translated into English in full and posted on the website. To shed light on this exchange and explore the underlying issues, I'm joined by Rashid Khalidi, the editor of the journal and the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. Thank you for joining us, Professor Khalidi.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Will.
CAMRA suggests this instance of an improper quotation shows that Ilan Pape engaged in falsification and fabrication. How does JPS respond?
Well, IPS naturally took the allegation very seriously because it implied that we had not been doing our job. It implied that one of our authors was guilty of unscholarly and unprofessional behavior. And we immediately checked the original quotation, which, in fact, Pape refers to in the text of the article. He says, Ben-Gurion, in a letter to his son, said so-and-so. We went back and looked at the letter to Ben-Gurion's son from 1937. And what we found, we thought, merited more than just responding to CAMRA. What we found was a quite remarkable text, which more than substantiates not only what Ilan Pape says in this article and another work of his, but also in a book, for example, by Noor Masadha, which the Institute for Palestine Studies also has published, and which goes in great detail into the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and into Ben-Gurion's role in it. And so what we thought we would do is to take advantage of this allegation to perform what we think of as a bit of a public service. We went and we translated the entirety of David Ben-Gurion's letter to his son, dated 1937, as found in the Ben-Gurion archives. We put it in the Journal for Palestine Studies where subscribers can see it, but we also thought it was so important that we would put it on the IPS website. And so everybody can now read in its entirety, with the full context, exactly what Ben-Gurion said about ethnic cleansing. And it is quite damning. It makes it very, very clear that it was his definite intent to remove the Arab population of Palestine as early as 1937, that this was something he had thought out fully, coming in the context, as it did, of the 1937 Peel Plan, the Royal Commission, which the British had appointed to look into the causes of the Arab rebellion that started in 1936 and which recommended the partition of Palestine. In that context, this letter takes on even more importance.
My next question is about the specific context of the letter. It seemed like Ben-Gurion was trying to assuage concerns that his favorability towards a partition plan was a compromise of the Zionist goal of a greater Israel.
Yes, I think it is, because at the time that the British issued the Peel Commission report, the Arabs were well into a full year of a revolt against the British occupation. The Peel Commission basically advocated the partition of Palestine into a very tiny Jewish state, and the attachment of a very large part of Palestine, the bulk of Palestine, to Transjordan, and the retention by Britain of a small area, which would have given it some important strategic regions of the country. And there was enormous criticism of this plan by the Zionists. It caused a terrible fracas within the Zionist movement. And criticism of Ben-Gurion and the leadership bloc that he represented for even considering this partition plan. And so in the letter, one of the things that Ben-Gurion is trying to do is to assuage this criticism.
Well, what about the general historic context? What was going on with Jewish immigration at the time on the ground?
Several sets of things are happening on the ground in Palestine in 1937. And I think the most important thing is that there's a shift in the balance of power in favor of the issue of the Jewish community in Palestine, in favor of the Zionist movement, and against the Palestinians. Even though they're engaged in a revolt against the British, which involved one of the longest general strikes in history, which forced the British to bring tens and tens of thousands of troops into Palestine to suppress it, which forced the British to launch airstrikes, destroy hundreds of villages, execute hundreds of homes in villages, execute scores and scores of Palestinian revolutionaries. In spite of this, the balance of power in the country has changed, and it's changed for several reasons. One is the enormous influx of Jewish immigrants as a result of persecution in Europe during the 1930s. Up till the 1930s, the Zionist project didn't really look like it was going to necessarily succeed. Why? Because it depended on establishing a large demographic beachhead in Palestine, which up until the early 1930s looked as if it wouldn't happen. It looked like that whole project was stalling. The total Jewish population of Palestine as a proportion of the whole was stagnant at about 17% for several years at the end of the 20s and beginning of the 1930s. Suddenly, with this terrible persecution in Europe, with the rise of anti-Semitism everywhere in Europe, but of course in particular with the rise of the Nazis in Germany, there was a massive influx of people to Palestine, the so-called Fifth Aliyah. This brought a huge reinforcement demographically to the issue, to the Jewish community, such that in 1 year alone, 1935, almost 60,000 or a little over 60,000 immigrants arrived in Palestine legally. That was more than the entire Jewish population of Palestine in 1920 when the British carried out the first census. So the Jewish population as a proportion of the whole went up from just over 17% to over 30% in a matter of a very few years. That's one background factor. And this is something that Ben-Gurion is aware of. Everybody's aware of. The Arabs are aware of it. The Jews are aware of it. Another thing that's happened is the economy of the issue, the Jewish economy, so-called, of Palestine, had grown larger than the Arab economy in the same period. There are other changes that have taken place. The Zionist movement has gotten stronger militarily. The British are arming it. The British are destroying, and would do even more to destroy, the Palestinians militarily by their suppression of the revolt. And so this is the context, this is the background against which Ben-Gurion can talk about expulsion, can talk about ethnic cleansing, can talk about driving the Arabs out, something that would have been very hard for him to do, say, 10 years earlier in the late 20s.
It's not often that issue advocacy groups like CAMRA make a big to-do about academic citations, which frankly seem like esoteric or kind of technical and generally boring. So what do you think is really at stake here?
Well, I think you're right. It is a little unusual for a group like CAMRA to do such a thing, though they've been known to do this kind of thing in the past. After all, what they're there for is to police the discourse, to make sure nobody says anything that, you know, goes beyond certain bounds. And those bounds are important to maintaining what I call a sort of basic myth narrative. This basic myth narrative, among its central pillars, argues that in 1948, the real, genuine owners of the country came into their own. The State of Israel was established. The Arabs were a transient population who didn't really belong there, who had only been there briefly. There are various ways in which this is expressed, but in any case, that lot left. They left under their own steam. Their leaders told them to. Whatever happened, it is very important to this myth narrative that they were not physically expelled in order for Jews to take their place, which in fact is what actually happened, which in fact is what Ben-Gurion actually said had to happen, which in fact is why this letter is so very important. So this letter relates to a key element of this myth narrative, which is why CAMRA went to the trouble of trying to do something about it. I hope we have used this opportunity to show that, in fact, this myth narrative is even more false than Ilan Pappe correctly showed it to be. What we've tried to do is to give as much more of the context as we possibly can by translating the entire letter from Hebrew to Arabic, and then posting both the original Hebrew so people can check it, and the entire letter in English translation on our website.
Well, Pappe, of course, is one of the new historians who emerged to challenge the basic tenets of Israel's founding history, which was accepted uncritically for decades by many. Do we see an opening in terms of the historic understanding in Israel, Europe, and the United States?
Well, let me say a couple of things. The first thing is that we do have to give credit to these Israeli new historians. But to give credit where credit is due, there are two other sources that people could and should have looked at. The first is the work of Walid Haredi, his seminal articles in the early 1960s. One of them dates back to 1959, actually, and Erskine Childers, and a couple of other researchers who back in the early 60s, in other words, a good 50 years ago, in fact laid out a thorough argument that showed that this myth narrative was false in all its essentials. Nobody bothered to pay attention to that. The second thing that anyone could have consulted and would have had this been any other kind of situation is the voluminous memories of the victims. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were forced to flee. Hundreds of thousands of people, all of them perfectly capable of talking, many of them illiterate in multiple languages. Nobody bothered to ask them. Nobody bothered to interview them. Nobody bothered to set what they had to say against the lies and half-truths and distortions that were the central pillars of this myth narrative. So that's the first thing to say. I mean, there would have been no need for the new historians had people been willing to look at either the work of Walid Haredi and a very few other people 50 years ago, or the work, or rather the testimonies of the victims of this ethnic cleansing. All of whom knew perfectly well what happened to them. Everybody knows what happened to their grandparents, to their parents, or to themselves, for the older people who actually are still alive and who experienced this. But having said that, I think it is certainly the case that enormous credit has to be given to the so-called new historians. In fact, they're not all historians. Some of them are historical sociologists. Some of them are political scientists. You have people like Gershon Shafir, the late Baruch Kimmerling. You have a whole range of Israeli scholars, many of them working in Israel still, some of them working outside of Israel, who have essentially gone to the archives and found in the Zionist archives, in the Israel State archives, and in other archives, material that shows that almost every basic component of this myth narrative is completely and utterly false. Their leaders did not tell them to flee. There were many massacres. It was clearly necessary for this population to be driven out, for there to be a Jewish state in Palestine. After all, this is a country with a two-thirds Arab majority, to which the partition plan gave 55% of the country. And that 55%, which was to have formed the Jewish state under the 1947 partition plan, the Arab population was almost as big as the Jewish population. You couldn't have had a Jewish state. You would have had a 51% Jewish and a 49% Arab state. What kind of Jewish state is that? So ethnic cleansing was an absolute necessity, logic tells you. But what the new historians have done is to show exactly how and why this came about in terms of the documents produced by the young Israeli state.
Kammerer has used this misquotation to appeal for sanctions by Pape's University, Exeter, in England. The university's investigation, however, exonerated Pape's scholarship. Would you say that academia allows for a more open discussion of these sort of myth narratives that you refer to than the public sphere in general?
Academia, at least in the United States, is one realm where, you know, both sides of the argument are being made. It's not as if a certain kind of Israeli version of this is not freely available in academia. There are many people who still write along the lines of the pre-New Historian version, related in some ways to this myth narrative. And moreover, there are people who, you know, and on the other hand, I should say, you have many, many more scholars now who I think are completely won over to the idea that the Palestinian narrative has to be given a fair hearing, and who understand that, in fact, much of what has been understood and is still understood in the public sphere about these things is basically false. So you really have a space, open space within academia, which is not to say that bad things don't happen. People are denied tenure. All kinds of nasty things do happen in academia, but if I were to look at an area which there's closer to an even playing field in American public life, I would have to say it's the university. Not every university, not always, but this marks an enormous change than from a few decades ago. A few decades ago, you couldn't really legitimately talk about Palestine or discuss some aspects of these issues without essentially being denied a hearing. It is now possible, growingly possible, increasingly possible for academics to do this, and you know, that doesn't mean there's still not an uphill fight in certain respects. But when one compares the university, not only in terms of what scholars themselves do, but what students, you know, think and say and do on campus, there is a real give and take in a way that simply doesn't exist in the public sphere, in a way that doesn't exist in the media. I mean, how many op-eds by people writing in favor of the Palestinians do you find in the American press? Very, very few. How many journalists steeped in, deeply rooted in the Palestinian narrative work as producers, work as editors, work as senior journalists in the American media? None, almost none. I mean, the late Anthony Shadid, you can count them literally on the fingers of one hand. So there's simply no, as it were, balance there. Whereas there are scores, hundreds, perhaps thousands of people who have relatives in Israel, who understand and feel and sense and sympathize with Israel and the Israeli narrative, who have all kinds of positions of responsibility and ownership in the media. Politics is even worse. In the media, there's a pretense of, you know, objectivity, and then sometimes there is objectivity. In the political sphere, it's entirely one-sided. I mean, you have a very, very few members of Congress who are willing to stick their heads above the parapet and defy AIPAC and defy the lobby. And it is a very, very, very hard row for them to hoe, obviously. So by contrast with our public life in the United States, and by contrast with the political sphere, the university is a much more open space. There are a few others like that, though. Some unions, some churches, many synagogues, in fact, and a growing area within the Jewish community. One does actually find open debate, but not in our political sphere, not in the political realm, unfortunately, in the United States.
What does it take for this more open understanding and the challenging of Israel's myth narratives that we see in academia to transfer over to public discourse?
You know, Will, that's not a question that's very easy for me to answer. I can tell you, and it's not something that, you know, the Journal of Palestine Studies or the Institute for Palestine Studies really is about. These are academic institutions, or this is an academic institution, the Institute. The journal is an academic journal. Its job is to try and deal in scholarly terms with all kinds of myth narratives and other issues, the Palestinian myth narrative, among other things. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of ideas, strongly held ideas, about Palestinian history that I've challenged in some of my work. And that's, I think, what scholars should do. They should be challenging all kinds of received ideas, idée fixe, whatever you want to call them. Now, how you translate that into the public sphere, how you translate that into politics, is, I don't think, a question that scholars can answer. I think that's a question for activists to answer. How can they immerse themselves in material produced by people who are, you know, essentially scholars in ways that will help them to dismantle myth narratives like the one that we've just talked about, which are so central to politics? And that's not a question that I think those of us who work on this side of things can necessarily answer best. I mean, as a citizen, I can tell you it's abhorrent to me that you have politicians rearing up on their hind legs like ex-Senator Santorum and ex-Speaker Gingrich and saying things that are manifestly untrue, blatantly racist, and are central to the oppression of the Palestinians. It's obviously a painful thing for any citizen to see politicians wallowing, as these two have and others have, in the gutter of lies, deceptions, and so forth. But that's politics. That's a sphere that, you know, as a scholar, there's not much you can say about. I mean, I've been attacked by the media. I've been attacked by politicians in different times in my career. And you realize that you're dealing in a different register when you go over there. I mean, as a citizen, as a person who's involved, you know, in the world, one has to expect that kind of thing. But you know, scholars by their nature are not very adept in doing that. So I think it's really up to people who are themselves involved in politics, who are themselves activists, who are themselves engaged in challenging the hegemony of this political monopoly view within our society, to try and use work that is done by people, you know, working on these subjects within the academy.
Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to speak with us on Palestine Studies TV.
It was a pleasure, Will.
That was Columbia professor Rashid Khalidi with journalist Will Yeomans, setting the record straight on Ben-Gurion's role in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Presidential candidate Marco Rubio opened himself to national security questions when he ran a campaign ad criticizing President Obama for spying on Israel. Journalist Ali Abu Nima took up the challenge with this article in the Electronic Intifada. He asks the question, is Marco Rubio a sleeper agent for Netanyahu? This week, Senator Marco Rubio released a television ad that slammed President Barack Obama on several fronts: guns, abortion, climate change, and the war on terrorism. In the ad, the GOP presidential candidate proclaims, America needs a real commander-in-chief and a president that will keep us safe. And as part of his indictment of Obama, Rubio states, he spies on Israel. Rubio's message seems to be that a strong and effective U.S. leader would not spy on Israel, and that Rubio would not greenlight espionage operations that keep an eye on that nation. No doubt that would delight Israel and its spies, who have long targeted Washington with aggressive espionage operations. As the Wall Street Journal reported last month, the U.S. intelligence establishment does snoop on Israel officials. This has outraged conservative supporters of Israel within the United States. But what has such spying unearthed? That Israel spies on the United States. That's not news. Jonathan Pollard, an American who worked for the Navy intelligence, passed a ton of classified information to Israel in what experts routinely describe as one of the most significant espionage cases in U.S. history. He was caught in 1985, convicted and sentenced to life in prison. In Israel, though, he was hailed a hero. And for years, Israel had some prominent Jewish Americans pressed for Pollard's release. 2 months ago, he was finally released on parole, but Pollard was hardly the only Israeli spy who connived to swipe American secrets. More recently, Jeff Stein, a veteran journalist on the intelligence beat, reported in Newsweek in 2014 that U.S. intelligence officials discussed the issue at a top-secret congressional briefing, noting, "Israel's espionage activities in America are unrivaled and unseemly, going far beyond activities by other close allies such as Germany, France, the UK, and Japan." A congressional staffer familiar with a briefing last January called the testimony very sobering, alarming, even terrifying. Another staffer called it damaging. No other country close to the United States continues to cross the line on espionage like the Israelis do, a former congressional staffer told Stein. This source disclosed that U.S. intelligence officials had cited industrial espionage, folks coming over here on trade missions, or with Israeli companies working in collaboration with American companies, or intelligence operations being run directly by the government, which I assume meant out of the Israeli embassy. In a follow-up story, Stein noted, despite strident denials by Israeli officials, Israel has been caught carrying out aggressive espionage operations against American targets for decades, according to U.S. intelligence officials and congressional sources. And they still do it. They just don't get arrested very often. In 2014, one of the documents obtained by Edward Snowden became public, revealing that the National Security Agency and the U.S. intelligence community had long worried about Israeli spying on the United States. A 2007 National Security Agency document, also leaked by Snowden, reported that Israeli intelligence was a leader in mounting espionage intelligence collection operations and manipulation influence operations against U.S. government military, science, and technology and intelligence community organizations. As the Wall Street Journal reported last March, Israel spied on the U.S.-led talks with Iran regarding Tehran's nuclear program. The spying operation was part of a broader campaign by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to penetrate the negotiations and then help build a case against the emerging terms of the deal, current and former U.S. officials said. In addition to eavesdropping, Israel acquired information from confidential U.S. briefings, informants, and diplomatic contacts in Europe, the officials said. It is one thing for the U.S. and Israel to spy on each other. It is another thing for Israel to steal U.S. secrets and play them back to U.S. legislators to undermine U.S. diplomacy, said a senior U.S. official briefed on the matter. And how did the United States discover that Israel was spying on it and using the secrets it obtained to subvert U.S. official policy? By spying on Israel. The White House discovered the operation. In fact, when U.S. intelligence agencies spying on Israel intercepted communications among Israeli officials that carried details the U.S. believed could have come only from access to the confidential talks. Following this revelation, Foreign Policy noted, Jerusalem's ongoing espionage campaign has worried U.S. officials so significantly that they have strenuously opposed an effort on Capitol Hill to include Israel in a regime of visa-free travel, which American spies fear will facilitate the travel of Israeli operatives into the United States. So back to Rubio. As a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he presumably is aware of the extensive Israeli intelligence operations against the U.S. government and American businesses. Yet Rubio, a favorite of the Likud-loving neocons, castigates Obama for spying on Israel and its spies. Would he really turn off all U.S. espionage programs focused on Israel, which would give the Israelis a free hand to continue their intelligence operations against the United States? I sent Rubio an email with two questions. One, does the senator believe that the U.S. government should never mount any intelligence gathering operations regarding Israel? And two, does the senator believe that the U.S. should not spy on Israel to detect possible Israeli intelligence actions aimed at the United States government, such as the Pollard operation? The Rubio campaign declined to respond. Without further clarification, Rubio is sending a clear signal. If elected president, it would be good news for the spies of Israel. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m., You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature Ion Pape speaking on his book, The Forgotten Palestinians. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.